Hello, thanks for downloading this podcast of The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. We're on the radio, too. Radio, you know, that thing with the crank in your emergency kit. Radio. Well, it sounds a bit like this. This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. Thanks for listening, and we are just learning some details on this first day of the month that could be the biggest blockbuster story in the very early days of the campaign for the 2016 presidential nomination. Official papers seem to have been filed in Westchester County, New York, family court. Someone named Hillary Rodham Clinton has filed for divorce from a William Jefferson Clinton. Now, whether or not this is the former First Lady and former Secretary of State and the former President of the United States has not been officially confirmed. There have been no statements yet from either camp. One political analyst who would only speak unnamed said a divorce at this stage of the campaign would deliver unbelievable momentum to the candidate, strike an unmistakable chord for Hillary's independence. It would confound her conservative critics by blowing the email controversy out of the headlines and be the biggest political game-changing divorce of the last several centuries. In fact, this analyst said it would be a divorce with as big a role in power politics as King Henry VIII. We have no indication of what the circumstances are in this divorce proceeding, and since we at The Takeaway are on the leading edge of this story, we will be following the ripples and repercussions all hour and all day long. Just allow me to add before you start tweeting, Hillary dumps Bill. This is wrong. This is a hoax. This is a joke. This is a surprise, our little celebration of April Fool's Day. And while we're at it, let's reiterate our respect for the institution of marriage, the Clintons' marriage and everyone else's marriage. And we are sorry if we caused anyone to drive off the road or to slip in the shower or to experience any consternation at all. I wish I could tweet you the faces on my friends in the control room right now here at The Takeaway. But later this hour, we will speak about how the brain is actually hardwired for surprises like this. We begin this hour officially on the program looking at the very serious political controversy taking place right now in the state of Indiana.
No one should be harassed or mistreated because of who they are, who they love, or what they believe. I believe it with all my heart.
It would not seem to be necessary for the governor of the state of Indiana, Mike Pence, to hold a public news conference to clarify that intolerance is not the law of the land in Indiana. But the governor believes Indiana's controversial Religious Freedom Restoration Act has been misunderstood as allowing private businesses to deny services to those who violate their religious beliefs, in this case, refusing service to gays and lesbians. After criticism and threats from companies ranging from Apple to the NCAA to Angie's List, saying they would no longer do business in the state because the law does implicitly permit intolerance, Indiana Governor Mike Pence came out on Tuesday calling for amendments to clarify the bill.
I've come to the conclusion that it would be helpful to move legislation this week that makes it clear that this law does not give businesses a right to deny services to anyone.
Joining us now is John Krull, host of No Limits, a news and public affairs show on WFYI and other Indiana public broadcasting radio stations. He's also director of the Pulliam School of Journalism at Franklin College. Welcome to The Takeaway, John.
Thanks for having me.
So what a week for the Hoosiers, huh?
Well, that's an understatement, I would guess. I'm not sure the state's had quite a week like this since the Civil War.
No kidding. What do you think in the way of damage control the governor managed yesterday, if at all?
As far as I can tell, I don't think he managed to dampen the fires at all. And really, he's in a trap of his own making here. And there are only a couple of ways out. I mean, I think the Indiana General Assembly either can repeal the law or he can say that gay and lesbian Hoosiers are protected by law against discrimination, and he seems inclined to do neither.
And even if he were to do that, it would be up to the legislature to go along with him, and that's their call, right?
It is, and one of the things you have to understand about this situation is even though there is a tremendous amount of public pressure right now for the Indiana General Assembly to fix this, the state's largest newspaper, the Indianapolis Star, took the unusual step of doing a front page editorial with a headline, "Fix This Now," in, you know, huge font. But the way the Indiana General Assembly is made up right now, it can resist a tremendous amount of public pressure because the legislative districts are so heavily gerrymandered. I haven't broken down the numbers yet for the 2014 election, but in 2012, 53.5% of the state's voters voted for Republican candidates to the Indiana House of Representatives. And somehow out of that 53.5% of the vote, Republicans ended up with 69% of the seats in the Indiana House of Representatives, which is a supermajority. Meaning they didn't need Democrats even to have a quorum. Since then, in 2014, they picked up a couple more seats. The majority in the Indiana Senate is 40-10. So that is has emboldened particularly very conservative ideological Republicans to act as if public input really is an annoyance rather than a necessity.
Well, there's no way to mischaracterize the backlash here. I mean, you've got Apple, you've got Eli Lilly, which is a local business, Angie's List, you've got Cummins, the engine maker. You know, you're talking about this has got to change. You've mentioned the newspaper in Indianapolis there. But I'm wondering if there is some movement afoot, a sense of politics in Indiana creating a sense of denial or I don't know, because you've got not only this, you've got this conviction on feticide, which is a very controversial case in Indiana that's buried in the headlines. You've got actually an HIV health problem that's been talked about in the state. Not things that you would associate with Indiana, yet it's all sort of happening as part of a what seems to be some sort of pattern here. How do you make this?
Well, I think they're all part of the other big story that we haven't mentioned, in part because it doesn't fall into the realm of social issues, is there's been an ongoing war over education policy in the state for the past couple of years. The lone Democratic statewide office holder is the state superintendent of public instruction, a woman named Glenda Ritz, who upset a very heavily funded incumbent, a guy by the name of Tony Bennett, in the 2012 election. And ever since then, the governor and Republicans in the Indiana General Assembly have worked tirelessly to strip her of authority. In fact, they moved a couple of bills through the legislative process this year that would remove her as chair of the State Board of Education and basically curtail all of her responsibilities. They're going to try to make the state superintendent of public instruction no longer an elective office. So in effect, they're overturning an election from a couple of years ago, in part because they have the authority to do so. The fact that they have supermajorities means that they don't have to be particularly responsive to public will. So there is backlash building, I suspect, and I think your point is well taken. I suspect the person who's going to bear the brunt of that is going to be Governor Pence, because the statewide offices are the only ones that can't be gerrymandered. But I'm not sure how much that's going to affect what's going on with the legislative process. The way those districts are drawn right now, it would have to be, you know, somewhere above tsunami levels for there to be really significant change.
Well, the values war is alive and well in Indiana, even as the legal climate in the United States is poised to nationally legalize gay marriage. So this is something that is definitely not going away. John Kroll, thanks so much.
Thank you for having me.
John Kroll hosts No Limits, a news and public affairs show on WFYI and other Indiana public broadcasting radio stations. He's director of the Pulliam School of Journalism at Franklin College. This confusion over discrimination or denying service and protecting religious freedom is also an issue now in Arkansas. The supermajority Republican Arkansas legislature passed its own religious freedom bill last night. Now Republican Governor Asa Hutchinson says he won't sign the bill, but he doesn't sound here like he's exactly vetoing it.
I ask that changes be made in the legislation, and I've asked that the leaders of the General Assembly to recall the bill so that it can be amended to reflect the terms of the federal religious Freedom and Restoration Act.
That's Arkansas Governor Asa Hutchinson speaking at a news conference earlier today. Joining me now is Arkansas State Senator Bart Hester, a Republican in Little Rock, and the Senate lead sponsor of the bill that now the governor says he's not going to sign. Senator Hester, welcome to The Takeaway.
Hey, great. Thanks for having me.
What do you make of the governor's statement here?
I think I interpret it very differently than you. He didn't say he wasn't going to sign the bill. He was very clear to avoid that question. And after the governor has said many times leading up to yesterday that he would sign the bill when it reached his desk, I think the governor is treating this like many other aspects that he does. We love Governor Hutchinson here in Arkansas. I have a tremendous amount of respect for him. He wants to be fair to all involved. He's asked for some amendments to the bill, but even if the legislature doesn't grant those, I'm confident he'll sign it.
So you don't think he's responding to the same kind of backlash that's going on in Indiana? And let's just say that, Walmart isn't exactly thrilled with this bill that you folks passed last night.
Hey, Walmart's in my home district. I live 3 miles from the Walmart home office. I think the very confusion about this is this bill does nothing to promote or take away someone's ability to discriminate. It does nothing for sexual orientation. This bill is solely about the First Amendment and free speech.
So you think it's free speech for, say, a florist to say to someone, oh, you're gay, you're getting married, I'm not going to sell you any flowers?
I think there's two questions there. I think for a florist to say you're gay, I'm not going to sell you flowers is wrong. That's discriminatory, and I don't think they should be able to do that. I think for a florist to say I have a strongly held religious belief and I don't want to provide flowers for a wedding, now that is considered speech in America. The Supreme Court says you can burn a flag. That action is speech. I think a florist action involved in something that they have a strongly held religious belief again, I think they should not have to perform that particular service.
So as long as they don't say the word gay, then as far as you're concerned, it's just a freedom of speech matter?
What I'm saying is a florist or a baker or a photographer or anyone does not have to do something that violates their First Amendment right to a strongly held religious belief. In the same way, I don't think that a Jewish baker should have to put a swastika on a cake for somebody. I think we have a First Amendment right to a freedom of speech, and if they don't believe in it, they shouldn't have to do it.
Is that illegal in Arkansas to put a swastika on a cake, to refuse someone to put a swastika on a cake? Do you know that?
No, of course that's not illegal. It's not illegal for a bakery to refuse service to anyone that's not a protected class currently. That's why I'm saying this bill doesn't do more or take away from that. Already a baker can refuse service.
All right. So the backlash, as far as you're concerned, is just a misunderstanding and we have to go.
Yeah, total misunderstanding. This is about freedom of speech, freedom of one's actions, not discrimination.
State Senator Bart Hester is a Republican in Little Rock and the Senate lead sponsor of the bill that Asa Hutchinson says he doesn't want to sign without some changes. Thank you so much, Senator.
Thank you for having me, John.
Support for The Takeaway comes from TIAA CREF, a financial services company helping to create financial outcomes that matter. Learn more at TIAA.org.
So on this day of pranks and tomfoolery, let's focus on the more visceral piece of April 1st, surprises. What happens to us psychologically and physiologically when a surprise is being sprung on us? What does that feel like? What did it feel like if it's already been done to you today? We're joined by Tanya Luna, co-author of Surprise, Embrace the Unpredictable and Engineer the Unexpected. Tanya researches surprise, has given TED Talks on surprise, and co-founded Surprise Industries. Welcome, Tanya.
Thank you very much.
So exploring surprise, I mean, how's that different from, boo? How's that different from just shocking someone?
Yeah, well, shock is actually part of the surprise spectrum, we like to say. So it's just one kind of surprise. Surprise is categorized as something essentially unexpected or misexpected. So it's anytime you were wrong and your brain tells you about it.
And is this a part of the sort of fight or flight, wiring in the brain? Is this something we're, wired to run away from? Or do we yearn for surprises? Do we like surprise in our life?
Yeah, really good question. So what happens in the brain when we're surprised is something we call the surprise sequence. So the first thing that happens is we freeze. So it's a strong neural alert basically telling us something is important about this moment right here. You didn't know about this. You have to pay attention. So our cognitive resources are just hijacked and pulled into the moment. So that's one of the things that's really uncomfortable for some people, but also exciting for some people, because your attention is just completely in the moment. Next thing that happens is what we call find. So this is the part where you get extremely curious and you're just trying to figure out what's going on, what's happening here. So we're curious, we're wondering. Next thing is shift. So if the surprise is something that forces you to change your perspective, then you have to change the way you've been looking at things. So if I wasn't expecting you to surprise me or give me a gift, and now I've just gotten this pleasant experience from you, I have to change the way I think about you and maybe our whole relationship.
How is it different if it's a win the lottery kind of surprise or if it's bad news surprise?
All surprise, from what we know in research from a neuroscientist called Wolfram Schultz, is that surprise intensifies our emotion by about 400%. So if it's a positive surprise, we're going to feel so much more positive emotion than we would if we had expected it. If it's a negative surprise, we're going to feel a lot more negative emotion than we would have expected it. So surprise is an intensifier.
You know, when I was thinking about talking to you, I thought to myself, all right, is lottery a good example? And I couldn't really tell, because it's my suspicion, and I've never won the lottery, so I don't know, it's my suspicion that everyone who wins the lottery expects to win, because they don't necessarily expect at that moment to win, but they expect to be a winner. And so on some level, it's sort of not a surprise when they win.
It's a really good point. I think it's kind of like a cognitive statistics game. So the more you expected, the least you're surprised, or the less you're surprised. The less you expect something, the more you're surprised. I would imagine, though, that the odds of winning the lottery are so low that you're always going to be surprised.
Yeah.
But I would say that, you know, the fact that our minds first go to something like the lottery is an important indicator of how we think of surprise as a society. We think of it as something huge. And actually, surprise can be tiny. It could be something like noticing something out the window, an interesting tree, and all of a sudden it just captures your attention. It still gives you that boost of dopamine. It intensifies your emotion and intensifies your concentration.
And you really did co-found Surprise Industries?
I did.
That's
not a prank.
It doesn't make jack-in-the-boxes or something like that.
No. So the idea behind Surprise Industries is giving people more access to surprise on a regular basis. So at Surprise Industries, you can sign up for a small surprise adventure. You can have a surprise sent to your home. At Life Labs New York, where I do training with Leanne Renninger, who's the co-author of the book, we train people in the science of surprise and how to apply it to their work.
What are those TEDsters in the audience who seem to kind of know everything? It might be hard to surprise them. They seem to have been everywhere, done everything. What's it like to give a talk about surprises to the TED folks?
Oh, I love the TED folks. You might think that they actually have been everywhere, done everything, but I think what's unique about that community is that they are so hungry for surprise. They are paying pretty good money and spending a lot of time just to soak up anything unexpected and unfamiliar to them. So, you know, I might be biased, but I love that community. I think that the reason TED has become so popular is people's need and desire for constantly changing their perspective, expanding their worldview, being intellectually surprised.
And there's a lot of talk at the TED conference about, you know, entrepreneurial innovation, surprising ideas. Is that close to what you're talking about, or very different from what you're talking about?
So closely related. I think about surprise in two perspectives, embracing it and engineering it. So on the one hand, you have to train your brain to be more comfortable accepting surprise. And by that, I also mean surprise readiness. So being comfortable with uncertainty, ambiguity, change, especially these days, that's an incredibly important skill, even if you're not an entrepreneur, even if you're just working in a company that's experiencing a lot of change. On the other hand, you also have to learn how to engineer surprise these days. So how do you, as an entrepreneur, as a
build
marketer,
it into a company,
yeah,
build it into a workforce.
Exactly. Even as a teacher, you know, how do you get people's attention and delight them so that you get them curious and excited about what you have to offer?
Now, how did you get involved in this personally?
Oh, boy. My sister, Kat, and I came up with this idea just really like in our mother's kitchen, spur of the moment. We don't really get along, but we get along really well when we work together. And so we said, what would happen if we designed a company where people would show up and they had no idea what to expect until they got there? And initially, we weren't going to call it Surprise Industries. It was initially called Go Learn Something. And the idea was you might learn kayaking, you might learn how to do fire eating, but you won't know what it's going to be. People hated the name Go Learn Something because they're like, yeah, learning algebra.
Yeah, exactly.
Right. So so then we hit upon the name Surprise Industries, and it really took off. And at the time, I hated being surprised. I loved surprising others. I hated being surprised myself. So part of my journey of surprise has been learning about the value of it for myself and learning how to let go and be surprised, not just surprise others.
Now, why did you hate being surprised yourself? And what experience sort of typifies that?
The feeling of being surprised?
The negative part of it?
I think it's the feeling of loss of control, the feeling of vulnerability. For me, I think as a kid, I had experienced a lot of change, and my coping mechanism was, I'm in charge. I control everything. Nobody controls me. I control, the world around me. And so I was protecting myself emotionally from those negative surprises. But what I've learned is that through that kind of coping mechanism, I was also keeping out joy, wonder, emotional intensity. So it just had this very like mild existence rather than really enjoying the ups and the downs for all they have to offer.
You know, a lot of people say the worst thing that they can imagine is a surprise birthday party or a blind date, that sort of thing. It sounds like Surprise Industries is about getting you a little bit over that, recognizing and, understanding that you're the kind of person who doesn't want too much surprise, but you need a certain amount of dose of it. How do you deal with such people before we go?
I think that for people who are uncomfortable with surprise, like I was, and in some ways I still am, it's all about teeny tiny bursts of surprise. So what little thing can you do that's unexpected for yourself? What conversation can you have with a stranger for 2 minutes that'll allow you to just stretch your comfort zone a little bit, embrace the joy of not knowing quite what's going to happen? I think it's all about small steps, small doses.
So should I tell you about the big spider on your chair?
I'm delighted by the fact that you worked in some kind of surprise. I would have been disappointed if that didn't happen.
Tanya, thanks so much. Tanya Luna is co-author of Surprise, Embrace the Unpredictable and Engineer the Unexpected. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Here's one from Seattle, Washington. My fiance told me my friends had planned a surprise 30th birthday party, so I had to pretend to be surprised in front of a room full of friends, including one who traveled from France. I didn't marry that guy. Keep the surprises coming. 8778-MY-TAKE is our number. You're listening to the Takeaway Podcast. I'm John Huckenberry. Here's a quick appeal. The more subscribers we have, the easier it is for us to attract the sponsors to keep our show going. So if you like the program, please let folks know. A Facebook like or a follow on Twitter means so much. Thanks again for downloading this podcast, which is brought to you by the fine folks at WNYC and Public Radio International. A look now at a local health crisis as we try to decode why some local social factors might be contributing to an urgent problem in Daugherty County, Georgia. Daugherty is home to about 93,000 people with a majority African-American population. And according to the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation's county health rankings, the county has an infant mortality rate of 10.8 per 1,000 live births. That's nearly twice as high as the average in the United States. In our series, Zip Code Decode, How Where You Live Matters to Your Health, we see how health agencies across Georgia are working to lower infant mortality by combining intensive clinical expertise with sensitive cultural awareness. From Georgia Public Broadcasting, Bradley George has the story.
Going to the doctor is usually a solitary experience. It's just you and the doctor. Maybe a nurse or medical student is in the room, too. But this is the totally opposite experience of that.
All righty. So we're going to go ahead and get started. Okay, I'll let you move your chair a little bit.
I'm at the health department in Albany, Georgia, and I'm sitting in a circle with six women. All of them are pregnant, and they're all due at the same time. They've already been through the medical part of today's session, urine samples, ultrasounds, blood pressure. Most of their time today will be spent in conversation. It's all part of a program called Centering Pregnancy. Think of it as group prenatal care.
So we're going to move into breastfeeding. Breastfeeding! Are y'all Woo-hoo! Excited? Oh, Amanda's looking like...
That's Karen Baker. She's a nurse practitioner at the health department. And when she asks these women about breastfeeding their new babies, most say yes or nod their heads in agreement. But Jada Selma isn't so sure.
That seems like it's going to be a trial and error type thing where, they say, some people say that the baby will automatically nurse in the hospital, and some people say when you take it home, it won't, and it's frustrating. You have to call your counselor and get help, and But it just seems like a, yeah, like how do you feed him if he doesn't eat or, you know?
Selma is 34. When she found out she was having a baby, she was upset.
You know, it took me a while, the first 2 or 3 months of my pregnancy, to, you know, I was very, probably the darkest I've ever been, because I just felt so, you know, pushed into this situation where I didn't think I was ready for it.
Centering is used all over the country, but in Albany, where the poverty rate is 34%, it's aimed at low-income Black and Latina mothers. Dr. Jacqueline Grant is director of the local public health district.
The best thing you can do, actually, to reduce preterm births and infant mortality is to have great health care for women all the time. But we knew, since a lot of our women are uninsured prior to pregnancy, the next best thing is to get them in for prenatal care as early as you can get them in.
Get women to carry healthy babies to full term, and there's less likelihood of those babies dying in the first year of life. For African-American women in Albany, the rates of preterm birth and low birth weight are higher than the state and national averages. And to change those numbers, there's a lot of myths and misinformation you have to work through. That's where Valina Milling comes in. She's director of the Centering Program in Albany.
If I raise my hands up, the cord will hurt my baby. The cord will cut off my baby's oxygen supply. Many of these women, when we start talking about being careful about cleaning and painting the nursery, that always comes up. And that is something that's very real to them.
For the program to work, Milling says she and her colleagues at the health department have to meet women where they are. Some may have not seen a doctor since childhood. Others may need a ride or gas money just to get to the sessions.
They feel comfortable saying, I just got to tell you that I'm almost out of minutes, and so can I give you this number? You know, some of the things that might be embarrassing to tell just anyone, they just feel comfortable with us because we're spending so much time. Each session is 2 hours.
And those 2 hours, of course, also include a chat with an OBGYN.
And we're going to be on camera.
But she's not in Albany. She is in Atlanta, 200 miles away.
Hi, Ms. Miller. How are you?
I'm good, Mrs. Wilson.
Good. And this is Mr. George. Hi there. So nice to meet you.
Dr. Ann Patterson specializes in obstetric care through telemedicine. It's a needed service in Georgia, especially in rural areas. Patterson is also president of the state's OBGYN Society. She says there are 39 counties where women have no access to prenatal care. Many rural hospitals have closed their OBGYN units in recent years because they're not financially viable.
And so these women have to drive a long way. And there are some studies out that show that if you have to drive more than 45 minutes, the risk of having preterm labor is higher. Certainly some of these women are passing 7 or 8 counties before they get to obstetric care.
To close the gap, state leaders are looking at telemedicine, like what Dr. Patterson does. And they also want to see if they can attract more OBGYNs to rural areas by paying them more to see Medicaid patients. They're also looking at programs like Centering to bring down the infant mortality rate. Jada Selma, who you met at the beginning of the story, says it's made a big difference for her. Her worries have turned from having a baby to what to do after he's born.
My family is in Atlanta, and, you know, my baby's father's family is in Atlanta, but I have no family here. So if I'm still here before the baby's born, how to find a good daycare? Mm-hmm. Somebody that I can trust. I have a lot of fear about that.
Selma's baby boy is due in July. For The Takeaway, I'm Bradley George.
You can find out more about our series, Zip Code Decode, at thetakeaway.org/countyhealth. And find out how your community ranks at countyhealthrankings.org. The series continues tomorrow with a visit to Henry County, Tennessee, a very rural, very religious community looking for ways to improve rates of physical activity. We're asking you, how would you rate the health of your community? From Greenville, South Carolina, I would give it a 4. We are a small rural community. We do have a hospital, but it has been plagued with problems. And while it was recently purchased by a larger healthcare system, I understand that the transition has not gone smoothly. Weight issues, diabetes, heart problems, smoking, and cancer are all rampant here. Our unemployment rate is high, and jobs that are available don't pay well and have no health benefits for the most part.
My name is Manny. I'm calling from Miami Beach. I live in a wealthy area. It's very healthy, with everyone eating fresh organic food and constantly jogging, walking, and biking. It takes a lot of money and free time to eat healthy and exercise. The 1% are not only wealthy, but also very healthy. Where my neighborhood is lacking is in psychological health. I've never seen so many rich, healthy, unhappy people.
From Miami to Great Barrington, Massachusetts. Oof, it's a pretty sedentary community, unfortunately. I'm thinking about moving to Salt Lake or Seattle, where the culture of cool seems to be one of recreational leisure. Bridgeport, Connecticut, my community, a pocket between rich Fairfield and a more rural mid-state. We can't afford the expensive health foods and can't grow them or get fresh eggs from neighbors. Local fast food chains are financially healthy. We are not. How does your zip code affect your health? 877-8-MY-TAKE is our number. Love to hear your story.
Support for The Takeaway comes from Lumosity, introducing a 10-minute fit test to challenge memory, attention, and problem-solving. With brain games to calculate baseline scores and build a personalized brain training program, performance can be compared to global averages. Learn more at Lumosity.com.
We don't get fooled again. This is a story of a huge detour in the road of life. We play those lyrics as a celebration of April 1st, but once upon a time, there was a band called The Detours. They also went by the name of The High Numbers. Four guys named Pete Townsend, Keith Moon, Roger Daltrey, and John Entwistle. You know them as The Who. But in the 60s, they were the noisy musical voice of an impatient generation, something two aspiring filmmakers named Kit Lambert and Chris Stamp saw immediately in the four and decided to glom onto them, becoming way more than just roadie documentarian fanboys. Here's Pete Townsend.
I fell in love, I mean, literally, with both of them immediately. I mean, they completely and utterly, the pair of them totally changed my life. They shot the first film of the band and took us over then. Their original intention, I'm sure you know, was to make a movie, not to manage a band, but they ended up doing both.
A new documentary, Lambert and Stamp, takes the film these two artists and impresarios shot and tells the story of two men who set out to make a film, joined the entourage of a rock band, and never left. In fact, they ended up managing one of the greatest bands in the 20th century, The Who. James D. Cooper is the director of the film.
Kit Lambert and Chris Stamp set out to make a film, and they looked for subject matter for their film and found it in what was to become the phenomenon known as The Who. And they soon abandoned that idea and decided to become their managers. And in doing so, ended up mentoring and managing them to megastardom. But their early ambitions were as filmmakers.
And, these were very creative individuals.
Yes.
But shall we say generously, without an obvious skill set. I mean, they were kind of doing it as they went along. And,
exactly.
And here's an example of that from Chris Stamp.
We had no idea of what they did in the music business or what this whole world was about. We didn't come to the group as like professional managers. We never said we knew how to do it. Kit and I, we decided that we were going to make a film that would be our film. And that's when I came up with the idea of the rock and roll thing.
And let's just say that they made the smart decision. Filmmaking is pretty interesting, but, managing The Who, that's really interesting.
Well, they made it interesting.
Yeah.
I don't know that management per se was all that interesting before they came along. They certainly redefined the concept of what management was.
What was their relationship like with The Who once they became an integral part of the mechanism of this whole enterprise?
I think it was a you have two completely opposite guys in Kit Lambert and Chris Stamp engaging four other completely opposite guys, and I think that it became very much an extended family. The dynamics of the relationship of Kit Lambert and Chris Stamp were the fascinating aspects of that relationship were played out creatively through their mentoring of The Who, but you know.
And what was this trove of archival material that you came upon to actually make this project?
Well, it started with mainly with the film that Kit Lambert and Chris Stamp did manage to shoot early on. They did actually begin to realize their film idea and shot some early film. It's fascinating, fascinating footage.
How was Townsend? How was Moon? How was Entwistle back then?
What kinds of things did they say? What was their character? What are the young versions of these guys like?
I think what was so fascinating is all the guys in the Who are such distinctly different individuals. Pete Townsend was a young art student. Roger was, I think, like either a bricklayer or worked in the sheet metal factory. John Entwistle, I believe, worked in the tax office at the time. Mm-hmm. And Keith Moon, Keith Moon was Keith Moon.
Keith Moon was just the wild man.
Keith was Keith, yes.
And this is just for Keith Moon alone, this is a priceless archive.
Yes, absolutely. Yeah.
How do you think the band would have been different had Lambert and Stamp not come along?
Chris Stamp and Kit Lambert knew that to take the high numbers from where they were, which was an underground sort of like, I would say cover band, but they weren't writing any of their original material, and they knew that it was essential to take them where they wanted to go as the Who, that they write original material. And they went to the band and said, you have to write your own material.
Are there fingerprints on the songs?
Oh, very much so.
Which one?
Well, particularly My Generation.
I'm trying to cause a big sensation. I'm just talking about my generation.
It was Chris Stamp who, when Pete was writing My Generation, and Roger Daltrey was singing the song, it was Chris Stamp who suggested that the stutter be incorporated. Hmm. Into the lyric, my, 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 and a lot of people don't know where that comes from. Hey, we're pretty good at that.
How did Lambert and Stamp experience the apparent, at least to us in the trades, falling out between Townsend and Daltrey?
It didn't stop there. I mean, like, none of them got along.
Right, you know? Exactly.
Yeah, four just desperate. Like, I mean,
it's a real Brady Bunch family.
Yeah.
Here, yeah.
Well, you know, you had, as Chris Stamp says, I can't use the exact quote on the radio here, but let's say four difficult, complicated guys. There's a word that I left out. A very, very strong different personalities. And I think that a lot of the brilliance of the management and people managing skills of Chris Stamp and Kit Lambert was to how to keep four different creative individuals moving along in the same directive path without, imploding or exploding and falling apart. And there are many times where the band was threatened with that. According to Roger Daltrey in the film, Kit Lambert and Chris Stamp, the way he describes them, were, the fifth and sixth members of the band. So they were integral in the creative process. So that in itself implies that you would have a very different outcome had they not been there. I think he also describes them as the shell of the egg.
James D. Cooper, director of Lambert and Stamp, thanks so much.
Oh, thank you very much. It's been a pleasure, John.
I know you deceived me. Now here's a surprise. I know that you have, because there's magic in my eyes. I can see for miles and miles and miles and
And here's one more thing to take with you today. There's a race in the mountains of eastern Tennessee, 100 miles long, held every year, an endurance race that's just a flat-out battle between bodies and their outer limits. It has a finish rate of about 1%. It's called the world's hardest race. It's been around since 1986, started by extremoid fitness guru Gary Cantrell. 40 runners started the race this year, but for the first time since 2007, the endurance test had no human winners. Nobody. The mountains won, said Cantrell.
The mountains win again.
That's it for today. If you want to tune in with The Takeaway, take it with you. Subscribe to our podcast. Find us on iTunes and take us with you on your commute home from work. It's a great way to stay up on the news. Thanks so much for listening. I'm John Hockenberry. Happy April Fool's Day. This is The Takeaway.
Support for The Takeaway comes from the Henry Luce Foundation, for increased understanding of East and Southeast Asia, and the Rockefeller Foundation, whose transportation initiative is promoting equitable and sustainable developments in communities across the country.
I'm David Remnick, host of the New Yorker Radio Hour. There's nothing like finding a story you can really sink into that lets you tune out the noise and focus on what matters. In print or here on the podcast, The New Yorker brings you thoughtfulness and depth and even humor that you can't find anywhere else. So please join me every week for The New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.